So you have to come into it knowing that it is going to be a challenge. There's a lot of content, and but I think even more than that, being open to critically thinking in a totally new way.
Hello, and welcome to Making School Matter, where we dive into the science of teaching and learning and how it is transforming education. As more teachers and school leaders discover the power of understanding how the brain processes information and how creating the right environment can help learners thrive, the more this informs our everyday practices. On this show, I sit down with educators and school leaders who are bringing brain science to life in their schools and classrooms, using practical strategies to make learning more engaging, responsive, and making school matter for every student. Today's guest is Chandler Tawney, an upper school biology teacher who was named Michigan's Outstanding Biology Teacher of the Year from the National Association of Biology Teachers in 2023, and currently serves on the Michigan Association of Biology Teachers Board of Directors and is a National AP Biology Mentor Reader. Chandler, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm excited to be a part of this today.
Great. Can you start by sharing a little bit about your background and what brought you to Detroit Country Day School?
Absolutely. So I went off to the University of Michigan in 2012 and was thinking at the time that I would be pre-med. So I took all the pre-med classes, and in the midst of that was shadowing and volunteering. And I found that when I was doing all that, I started to have this problem of passing out. And it was scary to me. Being in the operating room, the pressure, the emotional part was something that I thought I would be able to handle, and realized that I love the science of this. I love the interactions with people, but I can't take this level of pressure and separating the medical from the emotional. So it was during my junior year at Michigan that I realized this is not what's meant for my future. And I always wanted to be a teacher since I was a kid. And I think it was that junior year at Michigan where I realized this is what I've always wanted to do, and why am I fighting it? I want to be a teacher. At that point, I was far enough along in my major, which was biopsychology, cognition, and neuroscience, that I figured I'm going to finish that off and with undergrad. And then I applied to the MAC program at U of M, which is a master's in educational studies. And because I took all the pre-med classes, I was certified throughout that MAC program to teach biology, but also integrated science and psychology. So I was able to use all of those undergrad credits toward education still, which was great. And throughout that year, I student taught at Belleville High School in a program called New Tech. And New Tech was all about project-based learning. And I taught in a bio-lit class. So we were every day integrating English literature and biology. So I had a really cool perspective of how to do that, and also how to make learning really relatable and relevant to students. And so when I graduated from my master's program, I interviewed in Las Cruz Public Schools at their math, science, and technology program, and got a job teaching honors in AP biology. So I've been there for the past 7 years and really loved my time there. The students are incredible. It's a really wonderful program. And I was able to do a lot with the biology curriculum and really changing it from a lecture-based program to more of a hands-on, student-centered program where we did all sorts of kind of the project-based learning that I mentioned. But after 7 years, I'm the person that I'm always trying to grow and learn, and I never want to be complacent in my teaching career. And when I saw this position open at Detroit Country Day, I knew what an incredible institution this was. And when I interviewed with John Corrigan, he told me all about the new StanX program that they were getting up and running here, about the science research program that DCDS does. And I just felt that, you know what, this is what I'm looking for. This is the kind of growth, the next step of my career, to now integrate research into my practice. And I knew the students here were incredible, and they definitely are. So I'm happy with the decision I made and happy to be a part of the community here now.
Oh, what a cool story. Excited to have you here. We're lucky to have you. There's this old story of learning science where, you know, students are brought to other people's discoveries and advancements, and then they input data and they output their findings, and kind of that's the goal of a successful science program. Now, I don't think there's anything wrong with working with other people's data, but I wonder, what is the rewriting of a news story that is taking place in your upper school classroom?
Great question. So I think to start, obviously in science and in biology classes, there's experimentation, right? There's doing labs and collecting data and analyzing that data. But I think my main philosophy is also realizing that science itself is a way of thinking. Yes, the labs and the experimentation are a big part of that, but my goal is to really help students rewire their brains a little bit to not just memorize, but really think outside of the box and think deeply about content. So kind of how I do this in a classroom is I help students to develop a model, whether it's a model on a whiteboard or I have these dry erase crayons that we draw on the lab tables. Sometimes I get clay out and we make 3D models with clay. And then so kind of is like an initial brain dump. You know, what do you think about a certain topic? And then we add to that. We learn more of the nitty-gritty details, and then students revise their model. So it's this way of, you know, you have this thought, but with more data, you can change and add and maybe delete some parts of that initial model. And so, another thing that I try to do is when students are learning a certain concept, that they then are exposed to a brand new scenario that they've never seen before. So how do we take what we know and now apply it to something totally new? And can we take that jump in thinking? And I think doing that is not easy, and it's not something that students are always accustomed to, but that's what science is. Science is not just memorizing and regurgitating facts. It's thinking deeply about real-world problems, too, that hopefully students are interested in, and seeing, you know, can we take that jump? And then with experimentation, I do labs in class, but especially in my AP Biology class, I also have a couple at-home labs that I have students do. So right now they're all creating their own sourdough starters, which I started myself during the pandemic and found that, wow, it's so cool to be doing biology in my kitchen.
And most of us did during the pandemic, right?
Yes, right. Perfect time to start some sourdough experimentation in all my free time. And with that too, you know, realizing like a couple students already have reached out to me like, oh, my sourdough got moldy. What do I do? It's like, let's start again. Like, it's fine. And in science, we fail sometimes. And I think it's from those failures that we learn the most. So realizing that even in a lab, it doesn't always have to be scripted. Students have some autonomy in that lab, and realizing that we fail and we have to pick ourselves back up. But we can also do it in our kitchen. So trying to just think about science in all these different ways.
And that novel experience happens outside of the walls of our classroom as well, right? So you experience that kind of, you know, biological phenomenon in your kitchen when you're feeding your sourdough starter, right? Thinking about that process too. So, one aspect of the scientific modeling process that you had brought up is making the individuals as well as the group of learners thinking visible. You know, and Mind Brain Education, or the MBE strategies that we've been talking about at Country Day School, suggest moving beyond the lecture. And so can you take us through your unit of properties of water? I was fortunate enough to visit your classroom during that time and was really interested in the way that learners were kind of building understanding. How do the scientists build knowledge, discuss that information, and ultimately create something that applies this new knowledge?
Yeah, I was so happy when you popped in that day. So at the beginning of the school year, actually the first day of school, every student got their own little mum from Home Depot. When they go on sale, I scoop them all up. And what they did is they watered the mum on that first day. They then put a plastic bag around it and sealed it off. And we did not give water to the mums the rest of the week. And their mums were in different conditions. Some were in the greenhouse, some were in the dark, some were in with a fan blowing on them. And what we did is we took the mass of the mum every day, and everyone realized, okay, the mass is decreasing. And in the greenhouse and with the fan, it was really, really decreasing. So then students are like, all right, what's going on here? Like, how is the mass just disappearing? Because we know that matter can't be created or destroyed. So what's happening? So then I took students through some of the properties of water, because the answer to this question is all about water. So they learned about the polarity of water and its ability to hydrogen bond and, you know, some of these little nitty-gritty details. And after we did that, the next day in class, we got out whiteboards. So I have these really massive whiteboards that I give to groups of 3 to 4 students usually. And I asked students to model and draw out how water bonds to other things. And the first prompt that you walked in on was, how does water bond to other water? That's a property called cohesion. So students drew that out. And as they're doing this, I constantly am circulating. I always tell them, I'm eavesdropping on your conversations. Pretend I'm not here. But I like to hear what they're thinking, how they're communicating with each other, and have follow-up questions for them too as I see fit, or maybe try to guide them in a certain direction if they're on the wrong track. And then I always pick a whiteboard that maybe it's great, maybe there's some room for improvement, but one that's usually legible and has some, you know, pretty decent information on it. So I have the whole class come over to that whiteboard. And I then ask those students, can you tell us a little bit about what you did here? What did you draw? Explain to us your captions. So I, you know, put students on the spot a little bit, but they know it's coming. And then as a class, we talk about, you know, what was really good about their whiteboard. Is there anything that we could do to make this even better? And then I have everyone go back to their whiteboards and revise as needed. So then I gave students a laminated glucose molecule. So glucose is a simple sugar. And this was the, kind of the next step of the modeling with a challenge. Like, okay, now you know how water bonds to water. Now show me, how does water bond to this new thing that you haven't seen before, this sugar? And so they made predictions, and then class was ending. And I was like, oh no, I wanted to discuss this today. So I snapped pictures of some of their whiteboards, and I put them on my Google Slides. So the next day in class, we went through the pictures of their Google Slides, and I picked a couple that were good but not perfect. There was something wrong in each of them. So I made it a challenge, you know, talk with your group. What's wrong with this? How can we make it better? And then we would have these discussions about, this was really good, this could be better. They all drew it in their notebook. So now they really had an idea of, okay, this is how water bonds to a sugar, and these are the nitty-gritty details of how to make this totally correct. So after we did all that, we went back to the transpiration lab, and at this point, they were starting to figure out, but I revealed too, that plant cell walls are made of glucose. So they're like, okay, well, if water can bond to glucose and plant cells are made of glucose, then water can bond to these cells in the plant, and maybe water's moving up the plant in this way, and there's this whole process called transpiration that we then got into. How water will climb up the xylem, this kind of open tube of in the center of the plant, all the way up into the leaves, and then water can evaporate from that point. So all of a sudden, light bulbs started to go off. Like, oh, okay, this is why the mass was decreasing, and this is why it was decreasing more with the fan or more in the greenhouse. So this took many days, and with our block schedule, it was about a week and a half until we got to this point. So in an investigation like this, there is a level of patience where students can, they're not going to know the right answer on day one. And I tell them, I'm not telling you, you're not going to know yet. But it's this process of little steps at a time that by the end of it, they were like, all right, we totally have this now. We drew it, we saw it in the lab, and now we're seeing how all these pieces of the puzzle fit together.
You know, it's so interesting when you talk about understanding a big concept, and learners are building on their understanding. And that one point where you had revealed that water can bond to the cell wall, and taking that one bit of information helps them to increase all of their other understanding and kind of building on that topic itself. And they're constructing their own understanding of it. This is a great illustration of how that happens within this unit. You brought up a couple of things that I'm quite curious about. One is kind of the interleaving of information, where you're continuing to come back to a piece of information or a concept, and students are working within their kind of short-term memory, long-term memory, which then leads to retention. How does that play into a unit like this?
Yeah, I think when especially in AP Biology, we're investigating really deep, difficult concepts. And there's so much information to know and to memorize. And I always say biology is a language in its own. So I think that's part of why this interweaving of, you know, knowing some of those little details, but then learning about this transpiration lab for a couple different weeks so that, you know, we're learning some of the little small parts about the bonds within water, we're then seeing it in this bigger picture of the lab. And I think it's that process of coming back and forth and almost creating this storyline in a way where that, like you said, it aids in retention and aids in understanding. And I remember as a student myself, I used to dread labs, honestly, because I never understood them. I felt like we had to do the lab, we had to analyze the data, and I did the lab report, but I never really knew why or what it meant. And I think that's now as a teacher, what I'm always constantly trying to do is I think about myself as a student, what would have benefited me to understanding this content on a deeper level. And I think that interweaving is something that it's a work in progress, right? I'm always trying to find new ways to do it. But to use that strategy to aid in that deeper understanding and long-term retention of data, not just spitting something out on a test and forgetting it the next day.
So that brings me to another point that I was curious about as well. So when, part of the MBE strategies is to give more formative assessment feedback more often than just leave it for that kind of, you know, summative assessment feedback. So the more often you can give feedback for students to apply, the better they'll understand it and the more they can apply it to further concepts. Can you tell us a bit about how you are using ongoing formative assessment when you're doing whiteboarding or modeling?
For sure. I think one thing with formative assessment that I struggled with initially when I started teaching is that when you have a lot of students, it's hard sometimes to give feedback, well, you know, written feedback, especially to every single student on every single assignment. And I think that's a big part of why I do this with whiteboarding, or like when I said, I put the picture on the board and we discussed it all together so that you can be giving feedback every day to, and it might not be to an individual every day, it might be to that group, but with doing that, you're forming those, you know, one-on-one connections with students. They're feeling more comfortable with you. They're not taking offense to the feedback, but they're like, oh yeah, that will help us now come up with the answer. Or in the class discussion, you know, giving feedback to everybody and making students though also drive the feedback, giving feedback to one another. So when the one group presented their whiteboard to the others, having this open conversation of what was good about their board, but what could we do to make it even better? And not in a way of what did they do wrong, you know, or they messed up this part, and not that at all, but having this culture of we're learning and growing together and we're making each other better. So not only giving formative feedback as a teacher, but training students to give feedback to each other in a way that's respectful and truly constructive criticism.
Yes, and it really is building a culture.
Yeah, for sure.
Right? And so building this type of classroom culture is not easy to create or maintain. And you were saying that this particular unit is the very first unit of the school year, and you're kind of jumping into a culture where trying something, building your understanding, working collaboratively with other scientists, creating a tangible artifact of understanding, getting feedback on it, constructing your understanding differently or reconstructing your understanding. So what groundwork have you laid that advances this type of thinking and student engagement?
So as you said, when I did this, this was week one of school. So it happens pretty quickly. I think you have to have some kind of buy-in from students, but also knowing that it does take time and it does take trust. And I tell students right from the get-go, every unit we shuffle seats. And I do it randomly. I count them off and we shuffle it up. So students are knowing right from the beginning of the school year, they are going to work with everyone in the class at different points in time. So they're already realizing, uh-oh, we can't just sit with our friends. Like we're getting pushed out of our comfort zones in this collaboration realm that we're in. But then making students, even from week one, try to trust that there's not a lot of pressure in this modeling. I want to know what you know. If you get something wrong, it's okay. Like I'm not going to be mad, or we're not going to judge you if you drew something the wrong way or explained something using the wrong term. We're learning together. And I think now that we're in unit three at this point, so I think students are realizing how this process works more and more. But it does take time. And I've said in the past that I pretend it's like a symphony in my classroom and I'm orchestrating this symphony. And now when I'm giving a mini lecture or explaining a concept, I'll say, okay, talk with your team, you know, about this for 2 minutes. And then we talk together, ready, set, go. And it like breaks out in song. That's like, and it's music to my ears, because at this point, students know, like, okay, we talk to our team and we discuss this. And this is just the culture of that class. But also, again, as teachers, it does take time. So being patient with yourself, if you're trying to go from more of a lecture style class to more of this collaborative, inquiry based, hands on environment, they have to trust you. You have to trust them. And you learn and grow together and realize that sometimes things work and sometimes things don't. So it is constantly an area of growth and reevaluating, even from the teacher side of things.
I want to uncover a possible misconception. And that is, you know, you had talked about me giving a mini lecture or moving away from a lecture style classroom to a collaborative, you know, modeling type classroom. Is there room for direct instruction in a modeling classroom?
Oh, for sure. For sure. And in a class like AP Biology, there's so much information. Like, we still need that direct instruction. So I do make Loom videos. So I've tried to do more of a flipped classroom where still a lot of that lecturing happens behind the scenes. But students have told me that they like the videos, but sometimes they still want that direct instruction in class. So after a survey I gave to students last unit and realized that, this unit, I'm doing the Loom lecture videos, but I'm still going to do a couple mini lectures in class, repeating some of the same information, but giving students that opportunity to ask questions, to hear it in person, to take notes in class. And I think it's a fine dance.
It's like a hybrid flipped classroom.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And direct instruction, though, is still okay. And we don't have to, like, go away from it completely. It's just finding ways to blend it all together so that it's not just direct instruction every minute of every day.
Yeah, well, we have to think about every learner. Mm-hmm. Not every learner experiences a video at home and bringing questions into the classroom best. There are many different ways of experiencing information, and I think you're describing a way where you are keeping every learner in mind and creating an environment where you can watch the video at home, bring your questions in, or you can also watch the video at home and have a learning experience in the classroom, and that will allow you to then, of course, work on that memory transfer before you start your group work and things like that. So, you know, we're thinking about a multimodal way of experiencing information in the classroom, which speaks to creating that experience for every learner.
Right.
Yeah.
And like I said, this is something I haven't done before. I never did a flipped classroom style in my previous job. So, and that's why I'm surveying students each unit to try to get feedback from them, because as teachers, right, we want to keep growing, but we also want to do what's best for our students. So I'm thankful for them too, for providing honest feedback that can continue to drive the AP Bio trajectory into a way that works for every learner, like you said.
Yeah. And I think having that kind of vulnerability in the classroom with your students, knowing that you want your learners to be open to that feedback that you give them and apply that feedback to ongoing learning. And you're modeling that in the classroom as a teacher. You're asking them for feedback on what worked best for you. And how might I be better at creating the environment for you to succeed in the classroom? And I think that's huge on building that rapport and building that trust in the classroom, where I'm taking feedback just as I expect you to take feedback. Right. And we're all working on becoming better.
Right. And sometimes it's hard, right? Like when I give those surveys, like that's the question I scroll to first, right? Because I'm like nervous, like, oh, what are they going to say? But as you said, that's what makes us all grow and learn together. We have to be vulnerable. We have to be open to feedback. Some of it's good. And sometimes it makes us think twice. But that's how we grow. That's how we continue to get better.
So now we're 4 months into the school year. Kids have been in this kind of collaborative learning environment for a bit, and now you are working on the unit of Life of a Cell. Can you explain this unit in regards to working memory and interleaving, which we had talked about a little bit earlier, and how does using the modeling process intentionally invite revision and building on a topic rather than kind of going bit by bit or block by block?
For sure. So in our second unit, which is all about the cell now. So we're zooming out a little bit, not just itty bitty molecules. Now, an entire cell, which is still very small. I started the unit with showing them a video from Harvard. It's called Inner Life of a Cell. And it essentially is a story of the white blood cell and how the white blood cell, which is a part of our immune system, will move throughout our body and eventually detect if there's something wrong, if there's, a virus or a bacteria that's causing an infection, or if there's a cut somewhere in the body that it has to go heal. But the video is so hard. The first time I watched it, I was like, what did I just watch? And I'm trained as a biology teacher. So the first day I show students this incredibly difficult 8-minute video, I have them write down, what do you know about this video? What do you notice that you recognize? So right away, they're picking up on some of the molecules that they've heard about before, or some of the cell organelles, the different, individual pieces within a cell that function a certain way. And they're like, okay, well, this feels like another language, but we at least recognize some of it. And then I tell them, okay, in a week, you're going to have a quiz on this video. And oh, you should see their faces. They are like, what? We're getting quizzed on this? And then I tell them, okay, well, we're spending the next week in class dissecting every single part of this. So what I do first is I model a jigsaw activity. So I break the transcript of the entire video down into 4 parts. And most of my teams are groups of 4. And they all break into one of the 4 different parts. And they become an expert on that part. So whoever's in charge of part 1, they read the transcript together, they translate it, and they start color coding. Okay, they color code cell types. They color code any proteins that they find in that section. And so they work together for about 2 class periods to become an expert. And then they revisit their original home team, where they have 4 different experts now on 4 different parts. And then they teach each other. So they explain their whole part to each other. So it's giving some of that, ownership and leadership of the students that this incredibly hard video, they're now an expert on 1/4 of it. So they teach each other. And then there's a whole array of questions that I have them answer. Now that you've translated the video, how do we start to understand what's actually going on here? So they do that for a day. Then the next day, we act it out. So I bring a hula hoop into the classroom and someone is the white blood cell that's rolling around. And we model the interactions between the different cells and how that white blood cell gets the message that there's an invader, there's something going wrong in the body and we need to do something about it. And that day is my favorite because it's fun for one thing. The kids are running around as, different blood cells. And I think there's a lot of light bulb moments that happen. So even sometimes acting something out can be a way of modeling. And at that point, again, it's still really difficult. And they do eventually take a quiz on it. And students did exceptionally well on that quiz. There's a lot behind the scenes on their end, too, of rewatching the video and going over the answers to the questions. But that is a way that I've taken something incredibly difficult, tried to break it down into these digestible chunks, giving students that ownership of becoming an expert, and then really understanding something that Harvard is teaching their students here at Detroit Country Day.
Yeah, it's incredible. And, thinking about the ways that you've described the joy that you're bringing to the classroom and the rigor that is involved in understanding something like this, right? So we talk about joy and rigor often at DCDS, and this is a beautiful vignette of that. One thing that I had thought about too is the classroom experience of enacting the cell in the classroom using hula hoops and taking on the persona of part of the cell. I've used many thinking routines in the past, and it reminds me of the name, describe, act thinking routine, where you give a phenomenon a name, you describe what it does, And then what does it act like in that area? And, you know, having structure around a learning experience such as, you know, you're really enacting the function of a cell, having a structure around that really helps bring things into alignment, right? You'd think that a classroom experience like that is kind of unstructured, it's loose, it's just having fun, when really it is applying your understanding in different ways.
Right.
You can answer the question of what are the types of a cell and you know, what's its function, but when you have to enact it and work together in a way that shows your understanding, it engages different parts of your brain. And I think that thinking about it differently will then help you build a deeper understanding of it.
Definitely. And on the teacher end, I do a lot behind the scenes before this day. So I have note cards already made of different types of proteins and different types of cells, and they're all color-coded a certain way so that when we're acting, everyone's like, well, who are you and what is this? They have a label that they're holding. So that is another way to make that thinking visible. So yeah, like you said, I think even with something that, you know, like acted out sounds like such a fun, casual day in AP Bio. But when you make it structured and intentional and, you know, you're kind of supervising and helping students throughout this process, it can be a way to think differently and experience this really difficult content in a totally different way. And so many students mentioned that that was one thing that helped them the most was acting it out. So I was like, wow, maybe I need to incorporate that into more of my teaching because it seemed to be an effective way to get them to understand.
Sure. And it's a very personal way of doing it, right? Because you are then taking on the persona of something and you are an active participant in a group that's also doing that. And if you don't act a certain way, then the cell doesn't work.
Right.
So it's a very personal connection to that. And
right.
So speaking of that, a strategy of MBE is making learning meaningful to each and every student. This is achieved by teachers helping students make meaningful connections for themselves. How do you create opportunities for each student to make these personal, meaningful connections to all the content? And how do you ensure their unique perspectives are valued in the learning process?
So I think, first of all, over the years, I've really transformed my teaching, and especially in my introductory biology class, into these storylines. And I've tried to pick storylines that are engaging and relevant and meaningful to students. So in intro bio, I do an outbreak unit where we learn about viruses and bacteria and infection and how does our body handle it. But I also teach them about macromolecules and cells and all of that throughout the unit. I have a unit right now in intro bio, we're doing discovering diabetes. And diabetes is a really personal connection to so many. I asked students who know someone with diabetes, and only one person didn't have their hand up in the room. I do a unit called curing cancer, which is very personal and a hard topic to talk about. But I teach students about DNA through this lens so that there's a reason, there's a meaning, and they eventually have to come up with a cure. And that's something that I'm hoping to integrate into AP Biology this year somehow too. So I think that's one part is I try to pick this phenomenon, these storylines that are sometimes hard to talk about, but are also really important and meaningful and relevant. And then in terms of just doing this with activities in the class, this year in AP Bio, it's something I tried for the first time. There is this activity by a group called HHMI Biointeractive. And I use their activity to kind of inspire my own activity in the classroom, but it's all about lactose intolerance. And actually only 1/3 of people in the world have the ability to break down lactose. So I show this little clip to students and with that fact, and they're like, oh, only 1/3 of people can actually break down lactose as adults? Why? Like, what's going on here? And students then go into this activity where they look at data from Europe, Asia, the Middle East, Africa, and we start looking at what percentage of individuals in these different parts of the world are lactase persistent. Do they have the ability to make this enzyme called lactase that can break down lactose that we have in milk and cheeses and things like that? So then students are like, oh, you know, this is where I'm from. this is like, I relate to this data. It's important to me, and I'm lactose intolerant, and it makes sense that this region that we're learning about, most people there are lactose intolerant. So it brings some of that like culturally relevant pedagogy into the classroom. And that was an investigation that we spent multiple days learning about, and eventually bringing natural selection into the story here of, you know, why was breaking down lactose so important 10,000 years ago to some of these populations? Well, some populations really relied on cows for their, you know, that's what they did, pastoralism. They bred and, you know, got milk out of these cows. And in times of famine, they relied on that milk to survive and to provide them with enough nutrients. So it's realizing that, you know, wow, years ago, this was really important. And then a student said, well, today we have so many alternatives like almond milk and oat milk. Do we feel that this lactase persistent trait might start to decrease in, you know, in populations? And then we had this such a cool discussion in class about, you know, is natural selection changing now because we aren't as heavily reliant on milk that maybe we were tens of thousands of years ago. So again, it was something that I tried new this year, and it was awesome. Like, I loved it. I think students got a lot out of it, making it meaningful to them, but also bringing it into today's society and looking at, you know, will this continue, or is milk and the reliance on it a thing of the past?
One thing that you had mentioned is that a question from a student had then jump-started the conversation again. And when you talk about making personal meaning out of things, concepts like lactose intolerant, or what was the other term?
Lactase persistence.
Lactase persistence, yes. Is my first time learning that term. Thank you for that.
Yeah, of course.
And just to think about that, you know, in the classroom, you're not only gaining information, but you're also creating your own questions, which then continue that inquiry process and continue the conversation in the classroom. But that question came from a student. That's not something that you had pre-designed, knowing that during a certain part of the lesson, I'm going to ask this question, and then we're going to talk about this particular concept. It was the curiosity from a student. That person shared that with the class, and then that jump-started another conversation, which made things relevant to everyone.
Right.
And I think that's such an important topic to talk about, is that in a biology classroom, the concepts are quite in-depth and complex. And it's not always the teacher who drives the instruction or drives the inquiry, right?
You lay
the groundwork, offer phenomenon or provocations. Learners are making meaning from it. And from that meaning, it's not the end in mind, is the knowledge and for them to be able to explain what they've understood. But another part of it is to be curious about it and be able to create questions that drives the thinking forward.
And sometimes as a teacher, you have to be comfortable with being uncomfortable, because there are times, I mean, we have some incredibly brilliant minds at Detroit Country Day, and they'll ask me a question and I'm like, that's a great question. Let's look into that. Because sometimes I don't know the answer right offhand, but I think it's also part of being human and showing students that we are humans as teachers. And sometimes we have to do research, or maybe you can, as a student, do some research for us and bring that to class tomorrow and let us know what you found. But being vulnerable to sometimes know that in a discussion like that, you might not have all the answers, but it's okay. It's part of that learning experience too.
I wonder, you know, what might this look like in your AP Bio class? You've mentioned that course a couple of times, but what would learners expect if they were in your AP Bio class?
So I think the main thing is that it is an AP level class, right? So you have to come into it knowing that it is going to be a challenge. There's a lot of content, and but I think even more than that, being open to critically thinking in a totally new way. I'm trying to get students ready for college, because in college, you are going to have to apply your knowledge. And when I went to the University of Michigan, I wasn't really prepared on how to do that. And I'm very open and honest with this with my students. I failed my first general chemistry exam at U of M.
Oh, boy.
I failed it. 48%. It crushed me. But it's something I openly share with students, because I did not know how to critically think. I did not know how to apply my knowledge. I was a great memorizer, but they gave me a new scenario and I stumbled. And I'm trying to inspire students in AP biology that if you stumble, stumble here, right? We have so many opportunities and people and groups to help you. And, you know, it's okay to fail and fail in a place that's safe. And, but then understanding that, you know, how do I understand content deep enough to apply it to this new situation? But I think also in AP biology, if anyone takes the course in the future, just being ready to have in an interactive science class where every day we're collaborating, we're modeling, we're learning from each other. So, you know, being open to that. But if it's also something that a student that's not what they particularly like to do, they're more of like a lecture-based student, I would even challenge that student to try to step outside of your comfort zone and experience a new way of thinking, because you don't know how you do in that environment unless you try.
That's true. Chandler, thank you so much for your time. It's time for wrap up and reflection and thinking about your time as a teacher using the modeling process. Can you complete the sentence, "I used to think and now I think"?
So I used to think that lecture was the way to get content across to students. And now I know that that's not the only way to do it. I'm hoping that, you know, more teachers too can feel inspired to try out this transformation. You can start small, and sometimes it's just, you know, one little activity here or there, or one way to flip one lecture, and, you know, maybe print out some, you know, laminate some pictures of cells and have students investigate cells that way instead of lecturing about them. Start small, and you know, but trust in the process and know that learning happens as a whole community, and your students will sometimes teach you more than anything else ever can.
And that's finding the joy and rigor.
That's right. Finding the joy and rigor.
Thank you. So if you'd like to learn more about the modeling process or AP Bio at Detroit Country Day School, please contact Chandler Tawney. To get a window into Chandler's science classroom, please follow her on Instagram at Ms. Tawney DCDS. On behalf of everybody at Detroit Country Day School, thank you for listening to Making School Matter podcast. If you enjoyed your time together, please like, share, and subscribe. For more episodes, you can find us on all of the popular podcast sites. And for more information on mind, brain, and education, or to learn more about Detroit Country Day School, please visit dcds.edu. Until next time, I'm your host, Mike Bedvinsky, and I encourage you to look closely, think deeply, and wonder incessantly.